You're in the session on a historical overview on rehab engineering, but they gave us the whole 75 minutes to fill this slot, and so we kind of changed it up on that. So I hope that's okay. We're going to actually, you know, you can read about the history from our paper that's in the proceedings. But we thought we would talk more about what's currently happening with rehab engineering and also kind of the future of what's happening with rehab engineering. So if we'd really been focusing on history, we would have had, you know, certainly Dave, you would have been up here and those, but we decided on some topics that you might be interested in as far as what's happening right now. Credentialing and education, outcomes and RERCs, both rehab, a task force that's been happening, and research and product development. Mark, did you want to say anything?
Yeah, you're up here.
No,
Yeah, this, as Patty was saying, this...
That's why the lights keep going.
This session sort of morphed. We wrote a last minute... Actually, we even had to get an extension on the paper in order to get it in on time. If you remember, you know, it's all history for us. And then we got the paper submitted, and then I said, no, we're not happy with it. Please pull it and give us some more time to put something together. So Tom and Patty and I think spent some more time putting much better paper together than the placeholder that we had originally. And then Rick Simpson emailed me and said, we don't have any other similar papers that, like yours, and I don't know where to pigeonhole it. Do you think you can fill a full 75 minutes? And so I said, sure. And so that's where we are.
Well, what they said is accurate. And that's what it really comes out to. Can you guys introduce yourself?
Oh, yes, we could. I'm Patty Barr. I'm a rehab engineer with Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare in St. Paul, Minnesota.
I'm Mark Bresser. I'm a rehab engineer, assistant technology specialist at Wood Services near Philadelphia.
And then I'm Carmen DeJovene. I'm a rehabilitation engineer at Ohio State University.
The Ohio State.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I've been getting so much ribbing about it that I actually purposely left it off when I said it. So I appreciate that. Keeping me honest, I figured wearing the tie was good enough. So what we did was we had 4 to 5 topic areas that we wanted to look at. And these are the individuals that agreed to come and join us. I'm going to get to you, Jerry. Don't worry. Roger's going to talk about what's going on in the accreditation arena for assistive technology and how that relates to rehab engineering. And it, you may have heard bits and pieces of it before, but I think it's good to hear it in this context. Glenn is going to focus on voc rehab and maybe a little bit on the service delivery side and also on certification or credentialing and where we're going. Jim's going to focus on outcome measures and the value of looking at the value proposition of rehab engineering, looking at that outcomes over cost, if you want to take it real simple. They're not shaking their heads, so that's good that what I'm saying is actually what they're doing. And Jerry is here, and he's going to talk with a Canadian accent, I heard, because he is he's helping out by... being here for Alex and talking about the research and development. You all have 10 minutes to talk. I have 15 minutes built in at the end for question and answer. Whether that really happens at the end, I don't care. This is a small enough group that, quite honestly, if you have questions, I'll bring the microphone, the fake microphone around to you, and we'll get those questions answered. So we'll start down at the end.
Are we doing this sans slides?
Sans slides.
Do you want slides?
Well,
I'll put them up for you.
We'll worry about it.
But then Roger's going to want some too.
I'm going to do a verbal description.
Verbal description.
Just read your verbal.
Okay.
video description.
We can always put the slides up later.
And Glenn doesn't know this, and actually our leadership doesn't know this, but Glenn, I actually would like you to go first, because I want to follow accreditation after certification, individual certification, from a historical standpoint.
Okay. Great. And accreditation, we're talking about training programs, whereas credentialing, which I'll touch on, is regarding practitioners or professionals in the field. There's been sort of an emphasis on history throughout this conference, which is nice, and we've had some early leaders in the field present throughout, and it brought back a lot of memories for many of us. I joined ResNet in 1980, and so I've pretty much been there since day two or whatever, but ResNet was really started by a lot of researchers. But they were researchers that were focused on one area and trying a lot of stuff out of labs and associated with rehab hospitals. So they weren't the sort of R&D that never sees anybody group of R&D people. But in the mid-80s, the activity and service delivery really blossomed and it became a big part of the field, big part of ResNet. And throughout the 90s, what was then REPSG, was, and maybe still is, the largest PSG within ResNet, RET now. And we had annual meetings at the conference where we talked about the need for a credential for rehab engineers. And the RET PSG at that time had about 400 members. And in those meetings, there were about 395 people. I mean, it was heavily attended. It was a hot, sweaty room, there was shouting, there was a lot of arguing going on. And as the leaders were looking into what requirements were out there, you know, the information evolved over the years. You know, I remember being in Pittsburgh in the room and somebody saying, well, hey folks, we found we gotta be licensed professional engineers. You know, I was like, oh great, you know, like few people had a path to even consider doing that. And then the next year, the word was different. Well, turns out we really don't have to do that. But so it evolved, and a lot of arguing. As ResNet had its quality assurance grant, which got credentialing for professionals off the ground, it included ATPs, ATS, and RET, or rehab engineer of some kind credential. So in that original concept, there was the framework to establish that third credential. I was talking the other day, ResNet had some difficult financial times, and during Mary Binion's term as president, you know, she came forward at a board meeting and said, we're gonna do the RET credential. We're gonna be faithful to that commitment that we made to that group within our professional society, and that was a really difficult thing to say on behalf of the organization, but give her credit, she had ResNet move forward in it. There was an ad hoc committee back then, the PSB worked on it, we achieved a exam-based credential. Over the years, many people looked into it. We did, at some point, probably 5 years ago, plus or minus, really identified that it needed attention, if for no other reason that the exam itself needed to be, you know, redone. But it was also a time to say, well, is that really the best model? Is the knowledge and skill base really that was present in that exam based on that time still in place today? And in general, the answer was no. And so there was a more major re-examination that's been necessary. Alex appointed an ad hoc committee to work on, you know, hey, what for the organization can you figure out what the pathway is to get that back online, if at all. And so we've spent some time doing that and have come up with a set of recommendations, which I'll touch on in a minute. Regarding service delivery, being at the conference for years and years, in my mind, the first several years, the rehab engineers they are presenting on service delivery were in the employment area, voc rehab. think that's where rehab engineers had their earliest identity regarding service delivery. I think as seating mobility exploded in our field, initially engineers were part of many clinical teams in rehab centers. With the changes in healthcare in the early 90s, let's say mid-90s, that became more difficult. And I think clinics with an engineering presence in seating mobility got greatly reduced or eliminated. And frankly, a lot of AT programs struggled to survive in the medical model, let's say.
And that's partly an evolution of the technology as well, right? There was less stuff you had to create for yourself, right, and more stuff off the shelf.
But I think that our identity in the employment area has always been there. Maybe we haven't given it the attention or recognition, but I don't think it's ever wavered. And I give the VR community a lot of credit for sort of being open-minded about who they call upon to draw in services to serve their clients. As I said, engineers have been there from the start. Pioneers like Dave Law and Leonard Anderson, John Leslie, clearly established that working as a rehab engineer, or these days RET, in the employment sector for state VR, for private VR, for a reasonable accommodation under the ADA is feasible to at least include in your service delivery package, let's say. And so I think that identity is still there. Working in a medical model is still difficult. And as the PSG looked into that a few years ago, like, well, there is a path to try and establish an identity and as a recognized healthcare profession, and maybe Resna will look into that someday. Kevin Caves, the chair of the PSG at that time, said, well, do we really want to embark on that? Because even if we achieve that, and it would take several years to do that, what kind of reimbursement is that going to meet? And is that going to be a viable financial base for rehab engineers to seek out and base their careers on? And so the decision was made essentially to hold off on that. But I think the identity in the employment sector is certainly there. I think there's a growing potential in the area of accommodation beyond that, you know, the physical space of places where people come for goods and services, and certainly in home modification. You know, the ADA is out there, ADAG's out there, but the need for expertise at times is needed in the environmental adaptation area as well. Jump to the ad hoc committee and recommendations so I can finish up is basically it's a bit of a different environment regarding credentials as well. Back when ATP, ATS, and RET were getting started, the word we were told is the only defensible system for a credential is an exam-based system, period. Nothing else. Okay. And that's it's a massive effort to do a job analysis and develop questions and test the validity of those questions, you know, with a limited sample size, so to speak, in our field. But we achieved it with the ATP, ATS, which became the ATP, and with the RET. The answer is different these days, frankly, as we looked into it over the last year, and even a consultant that Resna uses is open or was encouraging of considering other mechanisms. And you've got certified professionals, that's one, which could be exam-based. You've got earning a certification, which may be exam-based or it may be related to training that you take. But a third possibility we heard about was a professional registry. And by registry, we mean not a directory, you know, so you do a Google search or a search on the Resna website for who works in employment, let's say, but a registry that you earn a place on. And you earn it in much the same way as people have earned the credentials that we have. So a certain academic background, certain amount of work experience. Added features are documentation that you've gone through training that to us struck us as representing a comprehensive amount of training across what RETs do or could be called in to do. So as an example, maybe being required to take training regarding AT in employment, AT in agriculture, AT in accommodation, meaning environmental layout. to document a certain baseline training in addition to your degree that you might have, whether it be advanced degree to associate to even high school or GED. We're trying to build a big umbrella to make it possible for people from a wider variety of backgrounds to come in and be recognized. So academic background, work experience, further training in the RET areas, and then a portfolio review. So perhaps presenting 5 cases representing your service delivery activities, but it's also open at this point to a combination, maybe case studies as well as teaching a course. Maybe as well as, well, I was a project engineer on this research project, and this is the design work that I did. So that, and that's for others to really decide for sure, PSB and PSG to an extent with input, you know, what the possible mix might be. Again, building the biggest umbrella possible so that a person from a research background or training or service delivery or somebody wanting to work in those areas could see value in the credentials. So that's the direction that things are going in, I think, and the status of recognizing people in the profession right now.
952. That was good.
Without slides.
Any questions?
We should raise the lights, they're all falling asleep.
Yeah, well, I was going to say we could even do something real simple and open the track.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
So I've got a question for you. Actually, anybody can answer it, but so do we need a credential? Like, do you feel like we, you know, 10 years from now, kind of looking at the future, do we need a credential for rehab engineers and rehab technologists?
My quick answer is yes, and the best, what I go back to is not like, do I need a credential, but think about quality assurance and what about consumers and what about referral agents? Is there a mechanism to guarantee a certain level of expertise that they can draw upon and expect good services from? So if the answer to that is yes, then I think there's value in a credential. Now, it's a tough case in like Illinois, where it's a big state and maybe resources aren't there everywhere. Maybe it won't be a hard and fast requirement like the ATP in power mobility area right now, but maybe it would be a preference or a guideline to say, if you can book rehab counselor, try and seek out a credentialed individual as you seek out services.
I was just going to rebut and say, I just somehow think credentials are always important. There's always got to be, people are seeking value behind anything they do. And if you look at just higher ed itself and the idea that we're exploiting the idea of degrees, you know, and I work in a space where all people want to talk about are MOOCs and badging and just what the future of higher ed is going to look like, and we won't have degrees anymore. It's, well, behind that, people still have to have credentials because you have to know, you know, people are looking for some sort of value, so some sort of quick assessment of a, yeah, I wonder about the formality of credentials, you know, how rigorous, they have to be rigorous, but how formal do they have to be? Streamlining those credentials is the key of the multiple paths just seems to make a lot of sense. I think there will always be a need for credentials.
Sort of along the same lines for like, you know, students or young, you know, people who haven't even finished their degrees that they're working on. I mean, which point in your career do you think, you know, we should start thinking about certifications? You know, if we haven't even finished our PhD, for example, we're juggling a lot of things. I mean, is it, you know, which point do you think is?
That's a great question, because that would still be a barrier. You know, if you're in school or, you know, if you're working, you know, your first 6 months of your career, you're not going to have one of those pieces yet. And, you know, that's something to consider. Do we want to have in the system a way of a brand new professional to be recognized? Maybe you've got the other three, but you just don't have the case studies yet, or you don't quite have the work experience yet. It's a reasonable thing, though, to have some degree of work experience in there and cases that get reviewed, but hopefully the system would be designed such that it's not a long process for a student or a new professional to achieve the credential, that it's something they could do fairly early in their career. So thinking about it, I think it would be good to sort of have that scorecard and see, okay, I've got this, I've got this, I've got this, and let me work as efficiently as I can to get my work experience, to build my portfolio so I'm ready as soon as possible. So I would say while you're still in school, if you're interested in this field, would be not too soon to try and think about that scorecard.
So I just want to make sure, yeah, we have enough time for everybody.
So about 5 years ago, you said that leadership was sort of compelled to ask if this was still the best model for credentialing.
Well, and I think in particular, the PSB pointed out that, you know, the credential needed a lot of attention.
I mean, what brought that about? What was the crisis there?
Well, I think the numbers plateaued at a certain point, well before 5 years ago. And then as ResNet needs to go for accreditation of its credentialing program, you know, showing that each credential is up to date, that it's been updated as needed, became problematic for the RET.
Now, aside from the credential, that process of a periodic review of the credential, is that something you think needs to be more formalized?
It's very formal.
It is very formal.
I mean, it's but done in terms of a periodic review, is that something that happens every so many years?
Yeah.
Just help me understand.
Yeah, no, it's every year a report goes into the accrediting body, but every 5 years a formal review is completed. Let's move on.
Okay.
All right.
So, I want to kind of go back in history in the Quality Assurance Committee that actually preceded our individual credentialing that helped create the knowledge and skills and the charge and the mandate to go ahead and move forward with credentialing. And at that time, we said there's actually three areas in the field that probably could deserve some type of a quality assurance activity. And one of those being individual credentials. And so, and particularly, actually it was rehab engineering that was driving that. The ATP was just sort of a piece of that puzzle, but it was really the rehab engineers that needed one that there was nothing there that was available. The second piece was that the training programs, there's nothing that assures that any kind of, whether it's continuing education or primary coursework, there was nothing that provided any guidance or any kind of quality assurance for the training, the professional training of assistive technologists or rehab engineers. So that was the second piece. And the third piece, which is kind of interesting, revolves around teams because there's kind of an assumption or kind of a knowledge base that we have in our field that rehabilitation engineering and assistive technology is very rarely done by an individual because it's a group of individuals and a group of expertise that come together to be able to move things forward. So how do you accredit agencies, programs, and, you know, kind of teams along that line? Interestingly, that last one sort of had a patch in it through CARF, which some programs and facilities have taken on that opportunity, although we're not doing anything to highlight that. It's sort of kind of just off to the side, and maybe we need to talk about that. And then the individual credentialing really kicked off, and as we know, ResNet really became the leader and remains the leader in that individual credentialing arena. The other area is that professional training, and I have certainly become a big proponent in saying that the time is right. We have now matured far enough within our individual credentialing to know and have had the conversations of what makes a good basis in terms of skills and knowledge and, you know, the abilities to be able to practice in the area of assistive technology, rehab engineering. And so now, and lots of great experience with education, whether it's webinars now recently or courses, you know, here at ResNet, ResNet conference. A lot of things that we're now doing around the country. We have a dozen different certificates and training programs and degree programs around the country that are providing a good basis of experience. So we're at a point where we're ready to say, let's define what appropriate training is, and maybe that would also highlight what maybe not so good training is. And so what should professional training be in the area of assistive technology and rehabilitation engineering? I have to say that one of the challenges is indeed what is assistive technology professional training and rehabilitation engineering in terms of professional training. Rehab engineering might actually be easier to define because it can be more easily conceptualized as a profession as opposed to assistive technology because, as we know, RESNA and all of its interdisciplinary groups coming together to becoming sort of assistive technology experts, it's harder to say what is that profession if it's an OT plus or a PT plus or a speech language pathologist plus or a rehab engineer plus. I mean, what is that animal? Which says we really need to define that, but also it means that we probably have two different things we have to define and then multiple levels of both of those. But I think we're ready, and some of you heard that we're moving forward with, we're probably not going to be able to make everybody happy along every step of the way, but I think like we did with individual credentialing, you jump in, you move forward, you come up with a way of doing it, and then as we need over time, we modify it and improve it. But my hope is that we're on a path where next year, this time at RESNA, we're going to be able to make a proposal for having some type of professional credentialing within the ATRE arena, learning from and launching from all of our past work from the historical standpoint. In fact, much of what the conversation has been over the last year has been looking at what documents we already have, which are very rich in what are the fundamentals and the basis for a potential curriculum. And we do have enough experiences and enough programs around the country in terms of certificates and degree programs, even though we're not talking hundreds, we're not talking even dozens, we're talking about maybe sub-dozen, but we have some really good packages that we can look at to say, well, maybe this is a really good target, this is a really good place that we can define what a really good, solid professional program would be. And we're going to solicit a survey, so we'll be talking to the existing programs around the country in the next year and be able to come back and report how many programs might be interested in different types of accreditation of programs and how might such a thing run, and how much could we charge, and is there a cost model to be able to do this. The thing I keep falling back on and saying when those who say, oh, this is too big of a challenge and maybe we aren't able to do this, I fall back on saying we don't have to do this big. It doesn't have to be, you know, the professional accreditation like PT has that has huge operation being able to do that, or a lot of our kind of rehabilitation professional programs. I think the model that we maybe need to look at is more along the line of prosthetics and orthotics at the moment, of which there are 12 accredited programs. And it's a great place to sort of think, well, maybe we just start small. There's nothing wrong with that as long as we create a fiscal model that allows that to support that. So that's what we're planning and where we are at the moment.
Great. Any questions? Because we got time now. Roger did a great job.
I'll ask one, Roger. So the focus on credentialing of programs is going to be on rehab engineering programs.
We've been looking at the space of assistive technology and rehab engineering together. The rehabilitation engineering really hasn't defined much in the continuing education or the certificate areas. That's really been assistive technology. But we want to be considered in talking about both of them. So when we come up with our survey and proposal for next year, we'll be able to report back and say, here's how many are interested in RE, here's how many are interested in AT, here's the flavor of what they're interested in doing, and who would step up and say, yes, I want to be accredited. If there was such an accreditation, sign me up. And we'll be able to come back and tell you that.
And for now, approaching them as separate, potentially separate things, right, and keeping them distinct for now.
Actually, there's a couple different models. One is doing it separate. The other is because RE has to include the assistive technology piece. Maybe we're talking about an overlapping or a hierarchy or something.
Yeah, okay.
Materno is just now starting to talk about going in that direction. I'm not in the School of Engineering, but who would... Ron, the dean of engineering, is interested in talking to somebody about it, would they contact you? Would he contact you? What would he do? How would he?
Yeah, if it's around accreditation of AT or RE types of programs, I guess I probably at the moment. Or Mary Goldberg at the University of Pittsburgh also has been, she's been certainly leading this conversation as well. So either one of us.
Because it'll be just beginning steps, you know, but it's nice to talk to somebody who's got a framework in mind when you start taking steps in a direction.
And this is a place where if we're talking to a dean, we can sort of entice them and say, you know, you have the potential of being one of the first, you know, part of the charter members in terms of the accreditation process. And for some deans, that'll go, whoa, that sounds cool. For some deans, they'll say, why don't you go and work it out first, and we'll come back later.
Can you give an example of how this might work? Like, what it might actually end up looking like if it's, is it going to be a, it sounds a lot like you're talking higher education, because you can accredit in a lot of different programs. Can you just give an example of what it may look like, even?
Yeah, part of the challenge that we have as a field is that we're not so traditional in terms of professional accreditation. Professional accreditation is fundamentally, if you look at all of our sister programs, based on a university in a higher ed environment, for a particular entry-level profession. And in rehab engineering and assistive technology, it's not that simple because we're interdisciplinary, we're multi-level in terms of how we do our training today, and we don't want to ignore those things. Those are really important parts of the fabric of what the field is, and so whatever we do for accreditation needs to take that into consideration. On the other hand, because we've seen these other accredited systems work the way they do, I think we need to start by thinking, you know, yes, accredited programs probably need to have some kind of a site visit, although theoretically it could be an online program. So what's the site? The site might be a computer, you know, but there certainly is a team of instructors and administrators that would need to be interviewed and really carefully during that process. So there's probably some type of a, you know, in-person kind of a discussion to see is it real and how real is it. And we have models for that accreditation process with all of our sister organizations and accreditation programs, and that's probably not a bad place to start because we know that works. And then to say, do we want to do the online thing? Do we want to do the workshops and including other types of educational packaging thing? And then very quickly we start morphing over to the individual accreditation area, and maybe we don't want to do that. Maybe that can be handled in the individual accreditation, saying there's a lot of different ways you might be able to get the education. Maybe accreditation needs to be a little bit more structured in a more of a traditional way, at least to start with.
Thank you. Do we have time?
We do.
So, I don't know, I'm not exactly sure how, so, is it possible then for, you know, like, biomedical engineering programs to get accredited, and like, are we only talking about programs that are called rehab engineering, or is it, you know, other, like, biomedical engineering, rehab science, or something like that, they get accredited?
That's actually a great question, and it's an easy answer for me to say, no, it's not one type of department or one kind of school. Although accredited organizations right now, some of the social work says, you gotta have a school of social work. You've gotta be at the level of a school or a college in your university before you can get accredited. And so public health, same kind of a thing. You have to be a certain status. Because our field is so interdisciplinary, we're gonna have to be, right off the bat, I know we're gonna have to be more flexible. So we're gonna want to be able to accredit programs in bioengineering, in occupational therapy, in, you know, a variety of different, for assistive technology. Now, for rehab engineering, don't know. You know, so we'll have to be looking at that. So, but that's a great question because it does highlight how we're different than some of the other profession-based accreditation, you know, organizations. But they're also the ones that have defined themselves. I mean, those of us who work in universities know how much of a headache it is for program directors and deans. You know, if you want to do social work accreditation or public health, when all of a sudden you have to go to the administration on the campus level and say, I need a school or college of my own, and they go, right, you know. But what's interesting is look at public health and look at social work and look what they've done. They have made themselves, by that boldness, they've actually been able to elevate that profession into a level that becomes very understood. They've defined it and said, if you want to be accredited, you have to do this. So we might have to take some very interesting leaps to say, if you want to be accredited in rehab engineering, you've got to have these players from these different departments involved. You've got to have this level of faculty. You've got to have, you know, this level of participation to be able to move things up onto that level. It's going to be a fun thing to define. And there's some risk, and there's a lot of potential long-term payoff.
But it would never rise to the level where there's just not enough money in the field. There aren't enough jobs in the field to say the one and only type of academic program to be approved is something that's labeled a Department of Rehabilitation Engineering or degree in rehabilitation. There's just not enough jobs, not enough places that could be qualified to teach it, or deans who would come up with the money to allocate a unit, a functioning unit within a university with that label. So it's going to have to be initially based on credentialing a body of learning objectives that coalesce under some sort of a heading called rehab engineering or assisted technology, right?
Right. With likely credits attached to that. So the learning objectives that require this intensity in terms of the program, requiring this many courses or this at least this many credit loads and this amount of investment of the student and the faculty to be able to do that training frame.
Okay, we'll transition over now to Jim.
Oh, I thought it was going to go last, and it does not
matter. Oh, it doesn't matter. Okay, we can go.
The order doesn't matter.
The order doesn't matter to me. You guys want to play rock, paper, scissors?
You come from California, we do it different.
I'll go.
He uses real rocks.
I'm supposed to talk about research and development. How many of you are students now? That's what I thought. How many of you are researchers?
Sounds more like that.
You don't count. Okay. I'll give you a little bit of history of research and then talk about if you want to do research, you have to find money. And I'll talk a little bit about where that money is right now. The field of assistive technology and rehab engineering primarily follows wars. The advances in our field primarily have to do with wars. Civil War, the injuries were such that the only people who could really be saved were the people who needed amputations. So they amputated. The guys who survived the amputations then needed prosthetics. So for about 100 years, and even through World War I, the soldiers that survived their injuries required prosthetics. World War II was a little bit, pretty much the same thing. There were a few more guys who survived because by World War II they had some penicillin and they could keep people from getting infected. So they survived a little bit more, but it was still prosthetics. And particularly after World War II, the VA decided that the state of the art of prosthetics wasn't very good. They put a lot of money into a thing called the Veterans Administration Prosthetic Center that was in New York at the time. And they did a lot of research on prosthetics. And at the time, they were the foremost research facility in the world around prosthetics. I remember after the Six-Day War in Israel, there were a lot of Israeli soldiers that came to New York to get their prosthetics. Vietnam changed, Korea didn't change too much, except more guys got survived. There were big changes in Vietnam, because not only were there better antibiotics, but there were also helicopters. So these guys got injured. They wound up in a helicopter, they wound up in a MASH unit, and within 2 or 3 days they were in the States. So there were a lot of folks who survived Vietnam right, with spinal cord injuries that in previous wars would never have survived. So there was, now there's another need. There's a need for environmental control systems. Keep in mind, this is late 60s, early 70s. If you needed to turn on the television or change the channel, you had to get your ass up off the couch and turn the knob. People with spinal cord injuries couldn't do that. So came up with environmental control systems. Iraq and Afghanistan, again, there's difference. The guys coming back, there's a lot, most of them do survive because of medical advances and because they wind up in the States within hours, and because of body armor, we're back to prosthetics, because their core body is preserved, but because of the IEDs and the explosions, they lose their limbs. But the new thing out of Iraq and Afghanistan is head trauma, because these guys are getting blown up, and even if they don't think they have head trauma, they do. If you're in a vehicle, in an armored vehicle that gets blown up, there's a lot of stuff going on in your head. So they come back, and it may be months after they come back, they realize that they don't remember quite so well, or they get angry and so on. Not to mention the fact that PTSD is something that's more understood than it's ever been. There isn't a soldier that's ever lived that didn't have PTSD when they came home. War is very different than home. So those kinds of things are what drove research, primarily. In our field, the other things that drove it in the 50s and 60s, and even before that, were things like the polio epidemic. Okay, all of a sudden, there were a lot of people who were disabled who needed assistive technologies. There was the thalidomide debacle in the 60s. Not so much in the United States, but certainly in Canada and Europe. And then all of a sudden, there were a bunch of kids who didn't have limbs and needed assistive technology. And a lot of the founders of ResNa came out of that. Colin McLaurin, Doug Hobson, and so on, worked in that field. So that's the impetus or the motivation for a lot of the research that happens. Primarily because that's where the money is. When the soldiers come back, the VA is the agency that has the most money to spend on new developments. So that's why we see that VA has spent $100 million on the DECA arm. If you've seen the DECA arm, it's a high-level prosthetic. It's ultimately, well, the Johns Hopkins arm is the one that's brain-controlled. They spent $100 million on that because guys coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan need prosthetics. So that's where we are in terms of advances in prosthetics. In the civilian world, research really kind of got started and got a big bump in 1973 when the Rehab Act was passed and the predecessor of NIDR was formed. At the time, it was the National Institute on Handicap Research. And at the time they started, they funded, I think it was six, right, rehab engineering centers. And those six rehab engineering centers each had a different focus of research. And that rehab engineering program, the Rehab Engineering Research Center program, grew to right now there's 17 rehab engineering research centers, each one with a different focus. NIDR, over the years, every time the Rehab Act got reauthorized, there were changes in what was NIHR that ultimately became NIDR, which is National Institute on Disability Rehabilitation Research, which is now under OSRS, which is the Office of Special Education and Rehab, which is in the Department of Education. NIDR is the primary funding agency for research in our field. They have a number of different programs, not the least of which is the Rehab Engineering Research Centers. They have a program called Field Initiated Research and Development, which is a grant program that has no priorities. So you can submit a proposal, basically get somewhere between $150,000, $200,000. I think it's still $150,000.
What? $200,000.
Yeah, I think it's still $150,000 a year for 3 years, and you can write whatever proposal you want. You better justify your need really well, and that happens once a year. There's a number of other programs like fellowship program. If you want to do research, you can apply for a one-year NIDR fellowship, and they pay you somewhere around $80,000 or $90,000 for that year, and you can basically do whatever you want, assuming that your grant proposal gets accepted. The other thing is SBIR grant. An SBIR grant is a Small Business Innovation Research grant. The SBIR program is throughout the federal government, and each federal agency is required, that does research, is required to set aside a certain amount of money. Percentages change depending on the agency, but they need to set aside a certain amount of their research budget for small businesses. And the SBIR program is a three-phase program. Phase one is a six-month, around $100,000 feasibility study. Basically, what you're trying to do in phase one with 6 months and $100,000 is proof of concept. You have to prove that what your idea is will work. If that's successful, you can write a phase two proposal and get about $200,000 to $250,000 a year for up to 2 years to develop prototypes, do clinical testing, and so on. Phase three is the part that the federal government doesn't pay for, but that's the commercialization of your product. Okay, SBIR program has been pretty successful. It's had its ups and downs. And it's been corrupted to some extent. They've tried to fix it on the fly, but eventually the academics kind of figured out this was another pot of money, so they would kind of surreptitiously create small businesses for their grad students. They'd stick their grad students in and say, you now own this business, and then they would submit an SBIR proposal under that business's name, because you have to be a small business. But it was basically academic. They pretty much put a stop to that kind of stuff. The other agencies that fund what we do is NIH. There's a National Center for Medical Rehabilitation Research, NCMR, that is in a little bit of flux right now. Up until now, they haven't had their own money to provide grants. But now there's some talk that they might. And they collaborate with the other institutes in the NIH to fund assistive technology and rehab engineering research. They also have an SBIR grant that's funded three times a year. And NIDR's SBIR program is funded once a year. NIH has a program where they do it three times a year. The other one is NSF has a GARD, what they call a GARD program, G-A-R-D-E. Which is general and age-related disability research. They have programs for funding student projects and some other things. And I'm not sure if NSF has an SBIR program, but they might.
We have about 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Q&A, yeah.
Okay, so I'll jump to product development. The biggest problem that we have in this field is getting stuff like what you do in SBIR and what you do with all this research money. You come up with these products and then you want to make $1 million and retire to the Caribbean. The problem with our field is that our market is so small that you really can't get the kind of numbers you need in sales to make a living and to attract investors. So there's a thing called the Valley of Death. I had beautiful slides, animated slides and everything that I just did in the plenary session. Anyway, so there's a path where you can pretty much get to a prototype stage with research money, but then you're faced with this, what we call Valley of Death, trying to get it to be commercialized. So there's a really, it's very, very difficult to get products from a research phase or a prototype phase onto the market where you can, where people can actually buy it. And this is now, how much time do I have?
You have 1 minute.
1 minute, which is enough time for my advertisement. You may have heard about a program that we have, it's called TREAT. And TREAT is an NIH-funded program that will help you commercialize your product.
Can we pass those on?
Yeah, you can, if they're interested. And we also have another project where if you can't get your project commercialized, but you want to share all the great information that you have, we have a project called atsolutions.org, where it's an open source community where people share engineering information in order to have other people build their own. I'll ask any questions.
Well, you burned through all your time.
I did.
Yeah.
Stop.
So we're gonna go right to Jim.
Okay.
Because I promised Jim I'd give him full 15 minutes. I want Jim to go before you, just in case this happens.
Okay.
You ready?
Yeah. I'm just starting my.
Oh, you got your own. Oh, beautiful.
Stay on time. So I've been asked to talk about outcomes research, and just so that we're all on working within a similar framework of terms on that. Outcomes research really boils down to establishing what works for whom and why. And you can do that in a couple of ways. You can do that with so-called efficacy studies, and you can do that with effectiveness studies. If efficacy studies are showing that something works within a controlled environment, a relatively controlled lab environment, or a controlled service delivery environment, effectiveness studies are about showing that something's going to be working in the real world with a typical sort of expected set of services being applied to them. So efficacy and effectiveness. And so what is it that we're trying to identify that's working, right? From the rehab engineering's perspective and really from the AT perspective as well, it comes down to two things. Number one, it's either trying to show that the services that we're providing are effective services, or it can be the devices or environmental modifications that we're recommending. So either the devices and modifications, and that those work, or our services work. With the services, I think that's an area that rehabilitation engineering has not done as good a job as it could have historically, and really needs to in the future in order to support both the certification and credentialing initiatives that Glenn and Roger talked about. So what do I mean by that? I mean that showing that a rehab engineer on a team makes a difference, and that there are better things happen when a rehab engineer is either providing the services as a solo practitioner, or better things happen when a rehab engineer is part of that seating clinic team, or is part of that home mods team, or is part of that computer access and accommodation service delivery team. It's a very difficult thing to do. It's needed, but it's a very difficult thing to do. Because if you're going to show that the services are better, then you need, because of rehab engineer's presence, in order to set up a study, you need what? You need two groups. You need group A, that's providing services that does not have a rehab engineer, and group B that does. And to be able to do that over enough cases to be able to show and then follow the clients who receive services from those respective groups in the long run, and say and be able to see in the long term, 6 months down the road, a year down the road, that, oh my gosh, the folks who had a rehab engineer touch their case ended up better. So that's an area that will be a perpetual area of opportunity and need for rehab engineering outcomes research. A second area that's more global, that's rehab engineering plus the broader context of assistive technology devices, is being able to show that the devices themselves are working as intended, and that their positive outcomes are emanating from them. And with that, then we need to identify, what kind of devices are working, and how do we measure the effectiveness of those in ways that are meaningful? Well, what's a meaningful outcome? And then that gets into the topic of, well, what are the meaningful outcome measures that we want to talk about? For years, most of the literature reflected whether devices were just even being used or not. You know, the lowest possible threshold of an AT outcome is to say, well, it's being used, which presupposes that if it's being used, good things are happening for people.
Or it's being sold.
Yeah, or it's being sold, right, or it's being sold. Yes, and so that's, we need to set the bar higher than that. Well, what do you pick for outcomes? I get asked that question a lot, and it really depends on your context. It depends on who are you trying to please with your outcome study. Are you trying to please your boss, your center director, that your program is worth continuing? Are you trying to please your reimbursement agency to demonstrate the rationale and justification for the intervention? Are you trying to please policymakers and show that they might need to change their policies to favor a particular reimbursement of a particular device categorically, or reimbursement of a service categorically? And for sure, we want our clients to be interested, and we want our outcomes to be meaningful to our clients, to be able to talk to them at time of assessment and at time of recommendation, time of training, that, hey, we think these things are going to happen and here's why. And those outcome indicators need to be meaningful to the individual as well. And we want them for our own purposes, right? We want to know that with our own pride of wanting to do good things and wanting to provide good work, that we want to measure outcomes that are meaningful to us as well. So that's a constant challenge, and that's a day-long discussion in terms of identifying what sorts of outcomes might be most appropriate for individual situations. And I'm just looking down to check. I'm about at 5 minutes or so. And so if we're thinking about, and the type of evaluation I just talked about was effectiveness evaluation, where we're looking at more real world impact. What we've done maybe a better job at different points in time is doing efficacy testing of products. And this is really done by the companies making the assistive technology. It's done at the SBIR level, as Jerry mentioned, for companies that are developing their own products, where they're doing, you know, small group testing in fairly controlled environments, fairly controlled lab, or fairly controlled home situations, where you're saying, well, does the product work for this, you know, working the bugs out of a product, essentially, and showing that it can work at least once, and achieving product improvements for that. I think as a field, that's probably been done, the type of research that's been done most often, certainly in terms of devices. There's a third area of research that rehab engineers could get involved with, and that's in the area of general consumer products, not just simply stopping with assistive technology devices and environmental modifications, but looking at enhancing the usability of general consumer products, and with the thought of making them more inclusively designed, you know, or having adhering to a set of universal design principles, or being designed with universal design principles in mind. And that's an area where we could have more impact than we've had in the past by influencing companies, general market companies, with automobile manufacturers, software manufacturers, household products manufacturers, consumer electronics manufacturers, and encouraging them to have a broader outlook as they're designing products, and making sure that they are not excluding populations of, say, older adults and people with disabilities, or at least trying to design some features in. And actually, there have been a lot of successes in that arena, certainly within software, and having built-in accessibility features in virtually across platforms, and so on. But there's a lot of work yet to be done in terms of penetrating the general consumer product market, and making manufacturers aware that they might be able to do a better job. I'm not saying that they should be doing in all cases, but generally there's room for improvement in terms of their consideration of special populations. So any questions about that? That's really my general 10-minute or 8-minute spiel about.
That was perfect.
Yeah, Nathan.
So when I think about the work we do, I tend to think of the twin towers of maybe researcher concerns. The first one being accessibility, be it through accommodations or assistive technology or even universal design. The other one that isn't so often talked about is inclusion and increased participation in society. And you talk about outcomes research, and I would sort of charge it, it's so much easier to measure the efficacy and effectiveness of accessibility than it is inclusion. But the inclusion and finding ways how we can meaningfully measure that, and whether it's services delivered or even the AT that's delivered, the devices and products, result in increased inclusion and participation in society is just as important. Do you have any thoughts about that? You know, or do you, would you disagree with that? That trying to get at this question of just not merely accessibility or accommodation, but one of, especially in the physical built environment.
Yeah, well, sure. Yeah, sure. And accessibility, first of all, is setting a guideline or setting a standard, yeah, and saying you've got to have the door so wide,
yeah,
and that's either going to let people in who weren't able to get in before, or it's not.
Yeah.
And so that sort of evaluation isn't too difficult to do. Although what does need to be done is to sort of evaluate where those standards, where those set points need to be for each criterion, to make sure it's broad enough that enough people can get in the door or can access the toilet stall without turning toilet stalls into rooms this size, right? There has to be some sort of practical limit to how big you make something. So somebody's always going to be excluded by an accessibility guideline. There's always going to be a case where there will probably be people excluded either by their size or their ability level. You know, 5 pounds opening force for a door. Some people aren't going to be able to handle that. And so that's so the accessibility has it's important, and we can measure it, and there's probably additional validation work that could be done with the ADA as an example.
Sure.
Getting back to your question, I'm sorry about the inclusion.
Yeah.
That's a bear as a researcher, because how long does it take for someone to realize that they're included and feeling enhanced quality of life outcomes? That's a long time constant on that.
I live with social psychologists. They harass me all the time.
Yeah.
is there
but that's a 2 to 3, we're not talking something that's 6 to 8 months typically. Mm-hmm. We're talking about something that might take 1 to 5 years. Well, and then how do you measure that? And how do you then pinpoint that growth after 5 years back to the assistive technology, back to the rehab engineer services, being able to show that cause and effect given everything else that impinges on someone's life over that time?
That's important.
And we're getting close on time, so I know this discussion could go on a lot longer. I know Roger has something to say. And Patty, I'd just like for you to comment on what you're doing in terms of outcomes of Minnesota. I mean, I think it's a good case example.
Yeah.
So
we have a mobile outreach program, and one of the things we're asking is, do people have access to services close to home? So that's number one. Do they have access to the services at all? They might not even come 200 miles to the Twin Cities for services. And then some of the questions that we're asking about assistive technology is, well, again, about the services. Are you able to come to appointments more often? Are you able to take a family vacation? How is it changing the stress level in your family? And then some of the other questions that we're asking about the assistive technology is, are you able to have recreational or fitness, more able to go to those fitness or activities? Are you able to go out into the community? So those are some of the questions that we're asking, and we're seeing that people are. I mean, the fun one is over 30% of the people say that having services closer to home affects their ability to take a family vacation, and I'm like, yeah, that's why we do this, and that's important.
I just want to highlight the future side of outcomes related to our field, and there are several things going on right now that might be windows into some new kinds of things happening around the outcomes methodologies and data collection, and therefore what we might generate out of it. And I think they border on some of the participation inclusion kind of concepts. One is there is a brand new funding institute in the world called PCORI for patient-centered And that's its focus. It's an institute that is outside of any of the other federal agencies. It's the fastest growing funding source probably in the world, because it's based on health insurance. And as health insurance grows, that source and that funding actually grows. So they're scrambling to figure out how best to distribute the money to research in the area that's really patient-oriented outcomes as the focus. So that's one thing that's kind of like happening right now. A second thing is that in the medical arena, as we know, because out of pharmaceuticals, RCTs and traditional, typical, really strong group designs where you have an experimental design with somebody getting an intervention and another group not getting an intervention has really been driving methodology and outcomes forever, and has been really an albatross for our field because we don't have large N. We don't have the funding, and we don't have the ability to do enough RCTs to be able to demonstrate what we need as a field. And so we've been kind of struggling that all along. What's happened recently, though, is the medical field has found that there's a couple other methodologies that they're already going, oh, this is interesting. Maybe there's some other ways to demonstrate outcomes. One is this kind of little known thing that there's things called crossover trials, which are actually just N equals one. They're just single subject designs. But the medical system is beginning to accept those as individual kinds of research models, somewhat. But what's even more important than that is something happened recently called a registry. And it actually significantly changed some decision making in the medical field around a couple different areas. And I think one of those was hip transplants. And some of you guys know the whole hip debacle for a while. That what did we start doing? We had hips that were going in, and then all of a sudden the industry came up with this really new technology that's really cool called steel on steel, and they started putting those hips in, and the whole field said this is the latest greatest thing, and they put it in without a whole lot of data, but because
without looking at the literature.
Well, anyway. What ended up happening is they, because of the way it was set up, they also were maintaining a registry of data that was really kind of single focused data that was building a database on how well were these devices being used, not in a facility or not in a region, but sort of in a much broader sense, where they discovered that, gee, there was a big problem. And this is the type of data that I'm predicting is going to be the next generation data. That it's kind of along the idea of cloud computing. It's along the idea of doing crowdsourcing. It's the idea of being able to collect data with the individuals we work with on an ongoing basis that can be aggregated and mined in a lot of different ways. It's going to be really informative for making really good decisions. And I think that might be, there's not such thing as a magic bullet, but that might be actually the next generation outcomes methodology for rehab engineering.
Paul, that was great. Thank you very much. It made our life easy because when we got the phone call and said, go from 15 minutes to 75 minutes, we if we were in the same room, we would have been staring at each other, okay, what are we going to do? So I really appreciate all the hard work that you guys have done. You guys.
PCORI.
PCORI.
P-C-O-R-I.
Exactly what I was imagining.
Oh, good.
I actually think it could be a bigger. After you guys doing it, I'm sitting there going, this could be a lot bigger deal than just four of us.